Hello again and welcome to another episode of Voices from SA. My name is Nicholas Claude. I hope you're keeping well wherever you are. Before I introduce my guest, I would once again like to guide you to my Patreon page, www.patreon.com/voicesfromsa. There you can make a contribution of your choice and help keep the project alive, spread its wings, bring you more stories from across South Africa and, well, perhaps even across the continent. I'm actually off to Nairobi in March for the African Podcast Festival. And so that is something you could directly contribute towards with a small donation. So I'd appreciate that. My guest this week is John Clark. He's a social worker and activist. I interviewed John about a year ago about his involvement with the Golobeni community and the Amadiba Crisis Committee that goes back more than 10 years now in their fight to protect their land from being mined. So in this episode, John gives us an update on the situation. We chat just a little more broadly about the state of the world, our need to rethink our relationship with nature, some of the lawsuits he's being hit with, and, well, Jethro Tull and butterflies. So please enjoy now my chat with John. Thanks, John, for dropping by. And to give us all my faithful listeners, the cohort out there, and I hope many more beyond, just a little update on the Golobeni. Do we call it the Golobeni land issue or mining issue? I'm not sure. It's a mixture of both. We discussed this. It was sometime last year. Your work with the Amadiba Crisis Committee. I just want to, I think, for listeners' benefit, just give what I feel, well, my understanding of the situation.
Good.
That goes back to 2007, something like that, when MRC, or was it Transworld Energy and Minerals, Australian mining company, TEM, which is a subsidiary of MRC, which is an Australian mining company, the CEO Mark Caruso, made an application to mine the dunes in the Golobeni district of the Transkei, Eastern Cape, I suppose, which lies quite close to the KwaZulu-Natal border. So we would say sort of northeastern part of the Eastern Cape on the coast, I suppose, if that makes sense. That is now an ongoing dispute, and it's a struggle that you've been involved in since then, supporting the community, which has made it quite clear that it is anti granting of mineral rights in on their land. I suppose one point you made last time was that, you know, they're not averse to government support and government involvement in building their economy and their community, but through other means, through tourism in particular and farming. The granting of mineral rights would not only have a sort of direct environmental impact, but would also involve the forced removal of these communities from their lands where they've been living for hundreds of years. Is that kind of the dispute or the situation in a nutshell? Now, on Monday, you and the Center for Applied Legal Studies, the Amadiba Crisis Committee, who you are supporting, that is the community representative body. You had an application heard in the High Court, is that correct? Could you just now give us a sort of update on the situation?
Yes. It was an application under the Promotion of Access of Information Act, where...
Which you have used, by the way, in the past to get information...
To great effect.
Yes.
In fact, and that's what for me was so interesting, is that, you know, having been involved now for 14 years or so, the state of affairs in the country in 2006, when I got involved, was we were, you know, the Constitution, the Bill of Rights, the Promotion of Access Information Act was there. You know, we knew that information was, in a sense, the primary right that was needing to be actualized if any other right could be exercised. I mean, we can't exercise free, prior, and informed consent if you're not informed, if you don't have the information. So in that sense, it was very encouraging that we were able, for the first round, and people need to know that this there's a backstory to this saga, which is a very good news story of showing how a rural community were able to actualize their constitutional rights on a range of things, their freedom of expression, etc., in order to find out exactly what was happening in terms of this deal. We managed to get access to, after a bit of a struggle initially, but they gave us access to the first mining rights application.
Yes.
And we found all sorts of things there which were really suggestive that this was a swindle. Now, and eventually from 2007, 8, 9, eventually 2011, those mining rights were revoked because it was quite clear that it was dead in the water because of both the information we got from the Department of Resources and the information we got from the Department of Environmental Affairs and Tourism, as it was then named. And that was, for me, a wonderful case study of showing, well, this is what living in a constitutional democracy is about. Yeah. The tragedy for me is that since 2008, there's been this systematic erosion and tightening up of the state. I don't know how much it is because of how they were thoroughly sort of ashamed or beaten by the Ahmadiyya community on the first round because they had information, but they really had made it very difficult for getting unredacted information. You know, the mining company keeps saying, oh, this is, you know, commercial information, which we don't want our, you know, competitors to know. So there's been a court case argued on Monday in which the Centre for Applied Legal Studies as amicus made their pitch in support of the Ahmadiyya and saying, look, this is just not going according to plan. So it looks very much like that the judiciary has again come to help.
And this was to get more information about the most recent mining application, yes, which was lodged when in 2012, is
that's
that correct?
Right. Yeah.
One thing that intrigued me was that it said, or you were told that you needed the permission of the mining company in order to proceed with the application, which seems to me kind of illogical in a way. That a freedom of information legislation should be just that, that you can seek information on a particular thing. And obviously, to give the sort of target of that application the power to grant permission would seem to fly in the face of the actual purpose of the legislation.
Exactly. I mean, and let's this
point. Has that always been the case in that legislation that you would, was that a new, amended part of the legislation?
It's a trend that's developed in the whole sort of era of state capture. And if you put it in that context, you start realizing, I mean, in 2007, 2008, you know, there was the idea of freedom of free market systems, freedom for the private sector to partner with the state in public-private partnerships. The accountability and transparency requirement in such deals was that there should be free access to information, a free press, journalists being able to kind of report on it, look at the contradictions and the flaws. And, of course, and remember the whole fight we had over the secrecy bills. You know, there was a strong move to try and regulate the media. So I see the tendency within the department to take a very narrow and stingy view of making information available as indicative still of a symptom of this legacy of state capture.
Mm.
If we want to fireproof the state against capture in the future, this sort of practice within state departments has to go. It has to be challenged because minerals are now rightly in the custody of the state on behalf of everyone. So you cannot have a state with that, as it were, resource at its disposal, making decisions where we don't have transparency and inclusivity of all stakeholders. Not just the Amadiba and the Wild Coast, so they're the ones most directly affected. They're going to have to be removed from their land. But the fact that there's such rich biodiversity, at endowment of that area, this is a national heritage, you know. And the minerals are a non-renewable resource. And here is a place which has got these marvelous natural resources in terms of biodiversity, which could be a far better money spinner, if that's what people are looking for, than a short-term mining operation is going to last 25 years.
You see, that's where I sort of see this coming from. Maybe not a state capture perspective, but more a kind of obsession with the ANC and the Alliance in its history with mining as an industry, as a very kind of, that's been sort of, when we have now President Cyril Ramaphosa, who comes out of mining, Gweta Mantashe, true trade union mining, they seem kind of obsessed with it and have a very short-term view of what it's what it can do for the country and the economy. It's a kind of almost the last bastion of the government's ability to provide jobs through mining, it seems. And there's been no sort of imaginative thinking about the future path that the economy can take.
There has, and I think they're locked into this mindset. Of course, I mean, it's no, let's face it, South Africa would not be what it is today, or shall we say what it was in the 60s and 70s, as a modern economy, were it not for the mining that had taken place.
An apartheid economy.
An apartheid economy, etc. It did build up the our ability to actually kind of take our place in the larger sort of community of nations, because we have such a rich endowment of lots of different minerals. So it is, people would say, well, that's the obvious thing you need to use to actually keep yourself going. In a global economy where extractivism is become, unfortunately, still so much the norm, but not a sustainable option for the world. What perplexes us is that there's not this an imaginative view that recognizes that mining is not the game it's not the only game in town, and it's not the game that's going to enable South Africa to thrive in the future. There's a lot more besides the minerals below the ground that we need to be, treasuring. There's so much in terms of our biomes and the biodiversity. I mean, South Africa, one scientist told me, he is a guy from Austria, and I met him a few years ago at a conference. He was an A-grade international scientist in the field of botany. He was thrilled to be able to teach at the University of Qakwa because he could study the biomes that were particularly of interest to him, which he couldn't study back in Europe. Yeah. For me, it's as somebody who's a deeply, deep environmentalist, and I just love South Africa for this rich biodiversity and variety of biomes. I think we've got 7 or 8 or 9. Europe's got 2 or 3 left. So just from that point of view, not to mention the cultural diversity, the fact of all these languages. So my concern is that when we allow things to polarize around should we or shouldn't we mine, we need to reframe the debate and saying, well, how can we use whatever minerals we might have that are necessary? And I don't deny the place for minerals. I don't know if I told last time, I have a platinum stent close to my heart, which keeps me alive. I'm not an anti-mining activist in the radical sense. I'm there to say, well, he has a non-renewable natural resource. How can we use it in such a way as that we invest and build an economy of the future that is not dependent solely on continual extraction of non-renewable resources? And then, of course, that's when he frames the whole thing in the global context of where we stand in terms of having done that for too many centuries in the whole industrialization process, leaving the whole planetary system disturbed and disrupted.
Hmm. One thing I've meant to ask, what is it that TEM and MRC want to find in the sand dunes in Kolobeni? What is this prize?
It's the main and the most valuable mineral is titanium dioxide, okay. What they call rutile.
And that's the strong one, right?
Titanium. Very strong light metal that used in alloys, and it's, besides in applications of building spacecrafts to go to Mars. And I always love pointing to this extraordinary irony, is that South Africa is on these probes to see if there's any life on other planets. Hmm. And part of the need of the necessity of getting there is that they need to mine titanium. So they're potentially putting at risk our own biodiversity in destroying life on this planet in order to see what's pretty certain that there's no life on Mars. You know, this is far better we apply technologies and our means to actually making sure we live sustainably on this planet rather than sort of extractive. But that's the main one, and it has other applications, even things like suntan lotions and all the rest. So it is seen to be a space age mineral. It's seen to be a mineral that
military applications, I imagine.
Yes, certainly in planes and sort of arms and what have you, and because it's very light and very strong. Apparently,
look, I just realized I thought it might have been one of those rare earth minerals that. Are much talked about these days, that are used in mobile phones and that kind of thing. But it's not that. But still, it is obviously a valuable. If people are prepared to go to these lengths to get the mining rights, then it is seen as a valuable resource.
Yeah. And seem to be likely to be increasingly so because of, and there's some paradox around this too, because we need to have lighter machinery. We need to have less fuel-intensive machinery. So it does kind of like you need platinum in sort of catalytic converters.
Right, exactly.
It's to try and reduce emissions. So there can be...
There's a kind of weird sort of cycle there, isn't there?
And the concern I have, Nicholas, is that these are all important, valid perspectives that need to be intelligently interrogated in the sort of climate where you actually find a sense of trust and respect that we are all looking ultimately for the same thing, a sustainable relationship with the planet Earth, which then brings me back to why I'm so concerned about the stifling of the access to information. Because you cannot have a properly informed debate. There are two things which I think constrain information. The first one is, of course, state oppression and the use of the law as a way of frustrating people's access to information and putting us through huge loops that we have to go through. The other one is often the conduct of politicians, and this goes, not just, on all sides, where they get, too strident, too based on a fear-based type of approach and don't seek inclusive engagement. There's a tendency for a more polarized way of trying to deal with it. And that's just, for me, very exasperating. Mm-hmm. That it's a power over strategy. Well, I'm more powerful, so therefore I can do what I want, and we're going to usurp your power. And if we see how this is playing out in the United States, for example, with the, Trumpism, it's not about Donald Trump at the end of the day, because whether I like him or not, it's about the fact that information has been strangleholded by propaganda, by use of power, by all means possible, to basically keep certain people's interests in power, and that's what concerns me, and the reason I have a view about it is that I've seen how at the local level with the customary law. Under the traditional community, leadership, that there is an inclusive process. Right from the word go, I was amazed to see how democratic and participatory that decision was with respect to the mining. Mm. They gave the mining rights applicants a hearing. They gave the environmental people a hearing, and you know, and I still remember,
who's there in this context?
Well, I say the local community, the local residents, the Amadiba. So they were saying, look, you know, we respect
under the auspices of
if
the
you
chief.
Live here, you have a right to participate in these decisions that affect you. And for me as a social worker, that's really all I need. My job description is to ensure that people participate in decisions that affect them. So my concern is that. And I don't want people just to see this, John, you know, kind of like, you know, sort of on this hobby horse about the Khwalabeni. This is about South Africa's democracy going forward. I've just, funny enough, come from a meeting with a friend who's quite senior in the Democratic Alliance. I have friends in the ANC. I've tried hard to get some friends in the EFF, and they don't seem to want to talk. But the point I'm making is that you're a human being. You live on this planet. You have rights. Let's find a bipartisan or multipartisan way to begin to actually grapple with these problems. Because I don't have a solution, and they aren't. And let's stop thinking of them as problems and see them as predicaments that we're in. You know, and to be wary of those with solutions to problems, because they often have only got a partial, fragmented, and interest-driven attitude to the solution, to the problem. Now, this is John Kenneth Galbraith way back. He used to say, you know, the West's diagnosis of the problem in the developing world was always about what prescription they happened to have for it, rather than
trying to understand
an engagement
fully
with the people and say, well, let's deal with this in terms of its full complexity rather than simplistic sort of sloganizing.
Well, you think of the Americans in the Middle East today, you know. I mean, could there be a more confused position? I don't know. One of the consequences of your involvement with the Amadima Crisis Committee and your clash, dare I say, with MRC, is their efforts to silence you. And one of the ways they've done this is these slap lawsuits. Could you just explain what it's an SLAPP suit?
Yeah.
It's used in many countries around the world, although I have a feeling that in some countries now, the slaps suits have been recognized for what they are, as an effort to kind of mire any party in the quicksand of litigation, knowing that you don't have really the resources to fight a massive global entity. But maybe you could just give us some background to the slap suite, what it is.
Well, the acronym
suit, sorry, not suite.
Yeah,
and you know, how are you reacting to that now?
Yeah, well,
how can you react?
You know, the acronym.
I think you're being sued for like millions of rands. Anyway.
and it keeps escalating.
Anyway, let's start with the SLAP.
The SLAP means strategic litigation against public participation. So let's break down each of those words. People must participate in decisions that affect them. Social workers' job is to ensure that the vulnerable participate in such decisions. And to do so without necessarily having to rush to court all the time in order to get information. It should be done as happened in Pondo customary law, that everybody's invited and you talk and you have your point of view. So that's what a good democracy is. Now, the United States have got quite a long experience, and a number of states have, in the federal system, have enacted legislation to stop these sorts of actions in their tracks, because they've seen it as an abuse of legal process, as being vexatious, as designed to actually frustrate, because of the unequal power relation existed between them.
Exactly.
Large corporates, and it's not just mining, it's across, and of course people such as my people that I work with as a social worker, who are vulnerable and disadvantaged, who do not have that, but who have other resources, their solidarity, their et cetera, et cetera. So that's what it's about. And I was served with the papers first time nearly four years ago, July, when it was a few months after Bazuka Khadebe had been shot and killed, in a case that's still yet to be solved and
investigated, it sounds like.
Yeah, I mean, it's gone nowhere. I was quite vocal, because seeing what was happening to people on the ground, that despite the fact that I didn't want the story to be at all about me, given, you know, I mean, so just given my job as a social worker, quite apart from anything else, social workers worked themselves out of a job. The community was empowered. It claimed its rights. It did its thing. Got the mining rights initially revoked. Was ready to go to court to get them stopped. You know, so they were on the. Now I'm seeing, you know, people being shot and killed at the on the ground, and I was outspoken, and that led to an ever escalating number of claims against me from Mark Caruso, the CEO of the mining company, and his company MRC, which really, because of a book that I've written, because of things statements I've made, all of which. I expected were going to come my way when I got involved 15, 12, 13, 14 years ago, because I was working closely with Richard Spoor at the time. And at that time, Richard was being slapped as well by the mining company, by Anglo, because of statements he was making, also out of great frustration about the way they were treating his clients. So I'd made sure that I'd actually got my good paper trail, and that what was different to Richard's thing, he being a lawyer, me being a social worker, is that we seek to name, we seek to unmask the powers, and then we engage them. So I've got a long history with Mark Caruso of trying to engage with him and having a paper trail of me trying to say to him, listen, this is a volatile situation, you're playing with fire, and trying to advise him. And of course, you know that lovely saying which Al Gore made popular from, he said, it's very hard for people to understand something when their paycheck depends on them not understanding it. And of course, when your material interest is at stake, you want to, you don't like this information that's going to contradict your interest. So, his first round was to try and sort of vilify me and scorn and say that I was just this greeny beanie environmentalist, etc., who was basically trying to preserve the wild coast for his own recreational interests, not taking the fact account that prior to working there for 3 years, I was working in Africa as a humanitarian worker around Africa and dealing with very serious humanitarian needs. I even found myself in Somalia for a period and, working, and I knew what poverty was and I knew what was happening. So, in a sense, I knew then from that point of view that he was never going to be able to play those cards, those race cards and things, because I was simply staying in my lane as a professional social worker. And the question has to be asked, why is he not simply taking me to my professional counsel if he thinks I've been unprofessional in the things I've said to him? Well, because he doesn't really want the matter heard in court. He keeps laying one claim against me after the other, to the point where it's now become something of a chronic process rather than just an event or an acute situation, go to court, sort it out. And
You have never been to court?
Not yet. It's all on papers at the moment. It's amendments to pleas. It's all, the first
time... We are allowed to talk about it.
Yes, yeah. I mean, see, that's partly what he's trying to maintain, this perception that this is now sub judice. You can't talk about it, which is complete nonsense. Uh-huh. The matter has yet to be even heard in court. All that's happened is papers have been going between his lawyers and our lawyers in order to basically get, and we've been in what they call the discovery process. And in the discovery process, that's
when you exchange your information, and who's got what.
And I provided him with, all the information that I'd accumulated after 12 years to say, look, this is why I said A, B, C. It was true and it was made in the public interest. And that's the defense one has against the defamation case. And, of course, as he's worked through that material, he's tried to sort of... shut it down by adding more claims. And it's one of these things where I've got to the point now, and I've been discussing it with my lawyer. She said, John, don't play his game. You just carry on being a social worker, being true to yourself, true to your code of ethics and practice. Because what partly he's wanting to do is actually make me into becoming too much of the story. And I've got to the point of realizing it's not even about Mark Caruso in the sense of us two people who are having a tussle with each other over who's right and wrong and whose reputation is more at stake than the other. There's a broader dynamic happening here. And I, in fact, I found some wisdom in how to deal with it, and it just occurred to me. I have a friend who is HIV positive and has been alive now for one of the longest surviving members who's HIV positive. And he told me once, he said, you know, one of the secrets of his longevity and survival and resilience is he had to almost befriend his virus. He had to almost recognize it instead of resisting and denying and angrily about the fact that he got it, to actually accept that this virus, to befriend it, even though it was his enemy. So it's like sort of a very interesting way. He's still alive. And in that sense, I'm saying I've actually held no personal grudge against or resentment to Mark Crusoe personally. I am just getting on with my job. This is part of what, you know, the job description of social workers is the use of self. We know that people will kind of, you know, lay burdens on you if they're not comfortable. The interest I simply have in this matter is the truth. And, you know, if what I've learned and what's been told to me is proved in court not to be true, well, I'm the first one who would want to learn that lesson, for goodness sake, because, you know, I know that, you know, the truth will ultimately set you free, even though somebody says, first of all, it's going to make you miserable. But I've got to a point now, sort of, I suppose, psychologically, spiritually, of just saying, just carry on doing my job. You know, I'm into this trouble. How do we use this situation of the fact that my skin's been reluctantly pulled into this game in such a way that we actually make larger points of principle rather than get caught up in a sort of a
personal,
you know, a food fight. Makes sense.
Yeah. No, of course. And I suppose it goes to this ongoing now struggle about climate change and about the environment, does it not?
Yeah.
That we just we seem to, despite a sort of recognition, I suppose, by certainly the majority of scientists working in the field, that climate change is a reality. That I suppose capitalism, industry, humans are having a massive detrimental effect on the planet, and yet, I mean, even the last COP meeting now towards the end of last year just seemed to be very kind of insipid, and you just wonder what the future holds in terms of this struggle. What is your sense of the possibilities now for the fight against
It's interesting. I mean,
industrial capital, late stage capital.
Yeah, I mean, I think that I'm beginning to realize now that I was initiated into this whole issue that is now clear as to what it really is. We had vague idea at the beginning that, and the issue was, how do we as human species find a mutually beneficial and at least a benign, you know, relationship with the planet Earth? So it starts from that fundamental principle. And you say, well, whoops, that means that the global economic system is, to use capitalist terminology, is a wholly owned subsidiary of the global ecological system. We cannot have an economy without an ecology. Life, how do we have, and then the question becomes, how do we ensure we have an economy that serves life rather than life serving the economy? So that's the fundamental ethical principle that I came to as a 17-year-old doing a wilderness trail in the Umfolozi Game Reserve with a very far-sighted, you know, a ranger who just introduced me into this new old, into this paradigm shift of understanding this, that we can't do without life. We have to choose life. So that's really where it comes from. And now, as it's now run its course, I now realize that we're now seeing the consequences looming of having failed to do that. And I was just written a piece recently, which will go up shortly, in which I reflect on one of these moments of grace, as I call them, where in 2007, when I was just, you know, getting really into deep down and dirty into the Qulabeni thing, and along came one of my great heroes, is Ian Anderson of Jethro Tull. And I write about it, and people can read it. But the interesting thing is that wonderful song.
That will be published where?
It'll be published on Daily Maverick, hopefully, today or late tomorrow. But also, I'll put it up on my own sort of medium, you know, platform.
Cool, I'll put it.
But the interesting thing is, I said to him, Ian, locomotive breath. Is that just an allegory of a man in a midlife crisis, headlong to his death, and, you know, his, I said, because it speaks as a fantastic allegory of where we're going in the planet in terms of climate change. He said, sure. And learned that in 1970s already, Ian Anderson said he was writing songs about climate change. Mm. And there's another one of his hits called Sailing Away on the Thin Ice of a New Day.
Skating Away.
Skating Away, that's right. Skating Away in the Thin Ice of a New Day.
I'm a bit of a Jethro Tull fan.
Oh, yeah. Well, me too. So in that sense, it's been interesting that we can
hope
go
that doesn't lose me any listeners.
Well, I was actually going to bring my guitar
play untrendy it. To admit you listen to Jethro Tull.
Anyway. Oh, gosh.
But,
making is that this, you know, we can go to court, we can try and get legal arguments, but ultimately I think there's the place of artists, musicians, poets. This is where we're going to find the sort of the more insightful truths that we need to take us out of the crisis, which is not to say scientists aren't...
And communities as well, I think.
Yes, yes. And people that use their cultural memory who have now...
Yes.
Who have an and which is what the indigenous community of the Amadiba helped teach me.
Yeah.
You know, who are connected with the earth and are able to find different ways of expressing that reverence, which, of course, you know, we as folk schooled in a Western education, you know, need to sit humbly and listen to, because then we have the way in which they can begin to start assimilating what the scientists are saying in a way that at least inspires creativity and curiosity and hope. Because, you know, if you just take in a straightforward scientific or political or legal discourse, it can be terrifying. It really doesn't leave one feeling very hopeful, because it does not look good, you know, if you put the facts down on the page. But for me, it's always been this. Well, what is the role of the human species in this extraordinary complexity of life? Well, it's through the human species that the cosmos can gain consciousness of itself. We have this intelligence. We have this ability to reflect, to make meaning out of situations. Let's now play our role. And what is it about then, the human species, that is worth sustaining into the future? It's that. It's that creativity. It's that sort of curiosity. It's and this is borne out by my empirical experience as a social worker, counseling people in deep crisis with all sorts of terrible situations that they've had to deal with, who have found, hey, this is an opportunity for something new to take root in my consciousness and in my soul, and that's what will actually sustain us into the future. And to and that's why it's back to choosing life. Hmm. Back to Mark Caruso. A sad thing is that I can see his reaction against me as a kind of a scapegoating, because he really has vested his future in money, in his belief that he would make a powerful company and earn a lot of money, and then rationalize what he was doing and say he always wanted it to also be beneficial to the people at Qulabeni. And, you know, he would say, you know, this is the best thing that could happen for them. You know, at least they will have jobs. And so he would caricature the situation that exists. But deep down, I know that he really, you know, would love to see people benefit from what he's doing. But he's just trapped in an algorithmic sort of spiral of self-justification and rationalization. And I'm not saying that, hopefully not too judgmentally, because he's by no means the only one. Mm. It's part of a culture that comes with people when they have too much power for too long. We saw it under the apartheid era. We saw how that denialism. We see it also that it's the tendency of people with power. It dumbs people down. It affects their whole ability to, you know, to understand and to rationalize. They tend to actually lose empathy. And this is scientific studies which I've been following as a social worker too. To see the truth, what I say, not just speak truth to power, but to speak the truth about about power and how power, absolute power corrupts absolutely, is that famous saying.
Mm.
So that's really where I'm at, and I'm just hoping that this Kolobeni saga and what my own story will give people some reason for insight and to say, well, what can we do and to find the real source of power and how to find ways of seeking power with people rather than a power over a domination subjection strategy.
You were mentioning just before we started talking about wanting to go to Uppsala to read the rune stones, the Viking runes that spoke about the sort of speak about the relationship to nature and sort of the community's relationship to its surroundings. It seems like such a naive sort of idea now, that whole sort of going back to nature, or as you say, that sort of synchronicity with the cosmos. How do we do that when the majority of the world seems to be so removed from its surroundings, unable to connect, living in either shacks in a city or commuting to and from work without time to think about your reality.
Yeah, it's interesting because, I mean, the symbol that you talk about, one in particular, which my great mentor is a Chilean barefoot economist, Manfred Max Neef, who I met in 1993, and he came to South Africa. And he was known as a barefoot economist because he was looking at alternative ways of conceiving economics. And that point I made earlier about economies that serve life rather than life that serve the economy. And he stumbled on this inscription on this Viking runestone, and he thought, my gosh, this is a perfect representation. It's a Trinitarian triquetta, I think they call it, which shows a balanced, harmonious relationship between what he saw as being the world survival trinity, nature, humanity, and technology. Now, a lot of people caricature us as being sort of Luddites who are anti-developmental because we... No, it's saying that technology as a servant is what we as a human species have been particularly adept at developing. But for what purpose are we developing that economy? Which takes me back to, locomotive breath, piston scraping, using up fossil fuels to go to, headlong to our death, or using technology as we are doing right now, to actually spread consciousness and to find it and to remain in the sense of using it rather than allowing it to take hold of us and become an addiction. So, cell phone technology is marvelous, but you start seeing how in some ways with a lack of appreciation of the larger context, it can become an addiction, which really is very potentially pathological and dangerous for young children growing up. So it's that sort of sense of, and that's why for me, I say my role of what not a mind, but I'm trying to find community globally, given the technology allows us to do it, with people in other places who actually are also finding, hey, it does work when you start taking when you humble yourself to and make a choice for life. I mean, that for me, I keep coming back choosing life, because when you choose life, then you are choosing your own life, which doesn't mean to say you're going to live forever. But there's a sense in which your own life that you live becomes meaningful because, ultimately there's a future generation, there's future. And how can we ensure that this terrible, the downside of industrialization, which has caused this huge upset in the balance in terms of global heating, how we can actually say, well, there's lessons to be learned. There have been previous crises in history. So, human beings have this ability to have consciousness of history. I was interested to just see, are we looking at this big, kind of coronavirus story? It took 500 years before we got the hang of what was really happening with the great bubonic plague. The conventional wisdom of the time was, this is spread by bad air. And all the, scientists or the intellectuals were saying, and it just, it wasn't spread by bad air. It was spread by a flea carrying a particular virus, something pestis, I forget exactly, been carried by rats, been carried on ships. So the ships were the vector for the rat, which was the vector for the flea, which was the vector for something else. Eventually, when we realized that, well, then that's great. But you know what I found most distressing about that story is that there was an attitude towards cats in the 14th century that they were seen to be evil and representatives of the devil. Now, had they not had that attitude, the obvious way of coping with the thing would have been using cats. You know, so I use that as a good illustrative sort of metaphor for saying, well, where are the cats around here in the sense symbolically? Mm. What are the life forms here that are going to help us come through and to get out of this ridiculous delusion that somehow it's about money and financial capital? That's not where the solutions are going to come, and not from technology as an end in itself. It's going to come from people finding coherence with life.
You mentioned the coronavirus. It has been fascinating just to see how the news of that whole thing has sort of transpired and been transmitted, and the confused kind of information, you know, people posting on Facebook, you know, we're all going to die, or you know, we're not going to die, or this, that, and the other thing. I mean, how do you reflect on you spoke about knowledge and information being such an important component of being able to understand our world, and where we have this massive effort to disinform and confuse. I mean, how do we counter that?
And I think, and also fail to ask the deeper questions. On the corona thing is quite interesting, is that Tiara Walters wrote a brilliant piece in the Daily Maverick just recently with Don Pinnock, in which they've now traced the fact that the species jump that happened was all to do with pangolins.
We were discussing it last night. I couldn't believe it. I mean, what the hell are Chinese people doing eating pangolin in the first place?
Exactly. Now, and he has an endangered species. So the question which I'm looking at and trying to sort of get better...
Has that pretty much been established?
Yes. I mean, Tiara's article with Don Pinnock, who are two, you know, kind of highly respected journalists, they're not rushing around spreading fake news. And I know Tiara personally as a friend, and she and I have reflected often about the necessity for this right relationship between nature, humanity, technology, and using writing skill, her creativity, and she does it. I try and do it a little bit with some filmmaking and, you know, and my own writing. So that's, you know, that's something we can make feel that it's useful. But the interesting thing for that whole question is that...
The pangolins,
is that it looks to me that this is, in fact, there's still more research needing to be done. So there's still a need for good science. I mean, evidence-based, rigorous, good research, and I know a lot of scientists. And I was talking to another friend of mine who happens to be an epidemiologist. I sent to Tiara's article, I said, tell me, what do you make of this? She says, spot on. She says, she said, that's exactly the sort of deeper lesson we need to learn, which is that what the human species has done in terms of taking a very exploitative, unthinking attitude to the natural world and to endangered species. So the so-called bunny huggers of the world, those of us who love, you know, different forms of
love
species,
the pangolin.
Who love the pangolin, are just, we need to say thank goodness for this virus.
It might actually save the pangolin.
It might actually lead to, and if we are ready to learn those deeper lessons, and that for me is my role and why I think this podcast, who knows what influence it might have, somebody picking it up. You know, don't underestimate your influence, Nick.
Jesus. My 130 listeners, thank you all. And my two Patreons. Patrons. It was funny because we were discussing that just last night. I had my brother-in-law and some of his kids around. They're young youngsters as well. And they'd actually just been up in the Kalahari sort of tracking a pangolin. They missed sort of seeing it, but they were following the tracks, and so it came up in the discussion. And yeah, that was my first reaction. I was like, maybe this is going to stop people eating the bleeding pangolin. Or, I don't know, maybe using rhino horn. Who knows
what the
consequences could be.
I could talk all day with you, but I've got a story to tell, which I'm busy writing it up.
I know you could talk all day, John.
But let me just tell you this story, because people have often asked me, John, what is it that, why are you so absolutely obsessed by, you know, by this, by conservational issues? And it goes back to, and the butterflies that have been, you know, migrating or actually immigrating over the last, you know, kind of couple of weeks, which has been, you know, people have remarked in them, there's been a particular abundance of them. What is it telling us about climate? Now, it reminded me of when my son was 3 years old. He was, as all little boys do, they find a fascination with nature. He got a caterpillar from the garden, put it in a bottle, put some leaves in it, made it suitable for human habitation, and he put it next to his bed. And they, well, night after night, I said, well, someone, Sam, this thing's beginning to smell. Time to throw it. No, Dad, leave it. He then, one night, comes rushing through with a wide-eyed with amazement, because inside thing was a butterfly had emerged. Mm. So out of this stew of dead leaves, this new force of life had emerged. Now, that's not the end of the story. We let it go free. So those of people who know the butterfly effect, you know, that's the point, is that a little incident like that had a huge consequence for me personally, because a few, 2 or 3 years later, we were sitting watching 50/50 environmental program on a Sunday evening, and they
Jonathan Rands.
Yes, close friend of mine, by the way. I'm so sad about his death, because he loves the story too, and he encouraged me when he was alive to keep telling it, and that's why I'm doing so again. Sam was watching this film, and there was a story about the Brenton blue butterfly in Nature's Valley, you know, Knysna, which had been discovered again. Think, because, you know, lepidopterists had thought this was extinct, that there would be no, and yet they'd found this when they were there doing, I think, the EIA process for a housing development. And here they found this habitat and this butterfly still alive. Hmm. So 50/50 were now appealing for funds and support so they could actually find a way of actually ensuring that this habitat was preserved, and the local municipality was going to give them other land, et cetera, et cetera. Sam's watching this thing, and I remember it was Errol Felix, who said, we're raising money. Just make sure you have a pencil and paper so that you can take down the bank account number so you can make your donations. And Sam suddenly dashed off, comes back with a pen and paper. He says, Dad, take down the bank account details. We've got to save the butterfly. Dashes off and comes back with his piggy bank and starts counting out the money. I mean, I wept, Nick, because it was like one of those things that, oh, my gosh. That sort of seed of consciousness was, you know, sort of, you know, planted in him, you know, a few years before, was now in itself coming to fruition. And isn't it a beautiful story? Mm. And I was sharing it with James Clark a couple of years ago in 2006, before I got involved with Clilobeni, and I told him that story because there were also butterflies in abundance then, this Bella Orota thing. We got in touch with the people at the Brenton Blue Butterfly Place, Dave Edge, who's become, get his newsletters, how's the butterfly doing? Well, I don't know how the story's going to end, because I got hold of Dave, had a chat with him. I said, you know, with those dreadful fires in Knysna in 2017, the Brenton Blue Butterfly Reserve was completely destroyed.
Decimated, my goodness.
But was the possibility that this would still reemerge out of this dead situation? Apparently dead issue. Now, you can see why I'm thinking about. Now, maybe people might think I've got a very overactive imagination. What happened to Sam as a three-year-old was, for me, a source of incredible inspiration, which can explain why, you know, I am so passionate about wanting to seek to help the human species find that what I call mutually beneficial relationship with nature, And I mean, what Dave Edge and the butterfly conservation folk have done, as he was telling me now, it's all grown. He says butterflies are a very good bioindicator of the health of ecosystems, together with amphibians and others. So we need that sort of consciousness. I mean, Dave then ended up doing his PhD, and he's now one of the leading scientists. And I said, well, you know, is there any hope? He said, John, don't make your film yet about it. He says, talk about it, but we're waiting to see that when the next flight season, which I think starts in later in the year, he says that there may well be discoveries of other habitats and communities of the Brenton Blue. So is it about this particular species? No, it's about our human relationship with nature. And for me, how do we have more of the lakes, people like Dave Edge around, you know? I tease him, I said, with a name like Edge, you know, he's seeing so many species on the edge of extinction. So there's a bit of nominative determinism there. But I see a spiritual, mystical aspect to all this stuff. And I would encourage people not to think that they're forsaking their intellect by being, you know, mystical about these things. It's what's kept me going, and I hope it sustains me, because that's part of the sustainability debate discourse, is that it's not just how much money you can make and make sure that you reinvest blah, blah, blah in your pension funds. And all. It's how do you keep yourself in a state of mind, or get into a deeper state of mind, where we realize that the human species actually do have a role to play.
John, thanks for your time this morning.
Thank you.
Excellent. We're all unique people treading this planet, but he's a bit special, John. Yeah, he's driven by a need to serve a cause beyond himself. It's quite admirable and amazing. I found it interesting that, you know, he's not anti-tech, as he says. He's got platinum in his heart, keeping him alive. He's not anti-mining or anti-technology per se. He wants a balance that serves all of humanity and nature equally, so that we can sort of reset our ways and hopefully survive the catastrophe we're in when it comes to the impact of industrialization and the growing reality of global warming. And, you know, as he says, the solution will not come from technology alone. It's about, what he says, people finding coherence with life. I thought that was quite a sweet way to put it. I suppose we all need to find some sort of coherence with the planet. Please become a patron, patreon.com/voicesfromSA. As I said, I hope to travel to Nairobi. I've got some interviews lined up, hopefully already. And, you know, with your support, this podcast can travel not only to all corners of South Africa, but beyond. I mean, imagine that. Thanks again to Chris Martis at Hindenburg for their support. Hindenburg software is designed for radio journalism and podcasting. It's practical and easy to use. Go to hindenburg.com for more information. You can sign up for a free trial. Voices from SA is available on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or indeed wherever you get your podcasts. Tell your colleagues, tell your friends, tell the world. Until next time, I'm Nicholas Claude. Cheers.